The chapter of Ready Player One covered in this episode features misogyny, gay panic, accusations of paedophilia, transphobia, specifically transmisogyny in outdated language, obsessive, predatory and persistent stalking behaviour by a man for a woman, and mentions a real-life figure alleged to have engaged in sexually inappropriate behaviour. As ever, I do my best to critique this book's handling of subjects like this, but if you feel you may be affected by any of these sensitive issues, I advise you to listen with care. Welcome back to Ready Player None, the only podcast that says, hey, you're doing great. We're following on from the last chapter, in which Wade managed to rent out an apartment during the length of a bus journey. Having travelled to Columbus, Ohio, where he can get a better internet connection, Wade vows to never leave his apartment until he's found the egg. Do we have an understanding? I certainly hope so, because it's time for level 2! So after another mostly blank page that just says level 2 on it, and the aforementioned quote from Groucho Marx, we're into chapter 17. This chapter starts with one of those homestuck pestilogues between Parzival and Artemis. This chat log goes on for about 5.5 pages, and it shows us the first time that Artemis has ever responded to one of Wade's chat requests. There is a distressing amount of realism here in how both of them type, because as somebody who was once a teenage boy, I'm cringing through time about 14 years. I can remember having conversations like this back when I thought this was how you were supposed to talk to girls. Right, let's get started. So Artemis starts off by saying yes, she's finally responded to his chat request, only to tell him to cut it out. You know, because they're rivals and they're always on the hunt, but it's not good for Wade to keep pestering her. Artemis says she prefers to use this chat log system instead of a virtual chat room, because when she's typing, she rambles less and comes off less as a flibbity gibbet. There's that word again. Wade says, I don't think you're a flibbity gibbet. You're enchanting. Artemis is like, did you just say that? Wade's like, I really said it. Artemis is like, you're full of crap. Wade's like, but you are enchanting. Okay. I don't like this. They talk about Wade's fame and how nobody knows his secret identity. Artemis says he's like a secret rock star. Apparently there's been a Saturday Night Live skit about them in which Wade's portrayed as an unwashed geek and antisocial nutjob. And we get on to the topic of gender. So apparently everybody thinks Artemis is a man in real life. That's how she's being portrayed by the media. That's because most Gunters are male, and they can't accept the idea that a woman has beaten and or outsmarted them. Ernest Cline's idea of feminism is mansplaining male privilege to the female character. So you're telling me, definitively, that you are a female? IRL? A female. A female. Red flag. Hashtag red flag. After analysing the available data, I've concluded that you must be a female. Why must I? Because I don't want to find out that I've got a crush on some 300-pound dude named Chuck who lives in his mother's basement in suburban Detroit. Hashtag gay panic. This really is an 80s throwback. But this is the first time Wade's told Artemis that he's got a crush on her. And she says, if she was still a woman who was 300 pounds and living in a basement, would he still? Artemis says he's got obvious boy vibes. Seeing the rest of this conversation, I agree. And Wade admits that he's been cyber-stalking her for years, ever since reading her blog. She goes on about how their simulated personas are not really accurate reflections of what them could be in real life. They're just sides of themselves that they choose to show to people. Wade says, well, I liked that side, and if you showed me your other sides, I'm sure I'd like those too.
No.
Wade says he'd never demand to see a photo of Artemis in real life, and in turn he'd never proffer to show her one of him. His stated reason? The female of the species has always found me repellent.
Oh, there are people out there who actually talk like this.
I don't find you repellent. Of course not. That's because you're an obese man named Chuck who likes to chat up ugly young boys online. I'm gonna have to record a trigger warning for this later, aren't I? Wade says he imagines that Artemis looks like her avatar in real life. You're kidding, right? That's the first rule of online romances, pal. No one ever looks anything like their avatar. When Wade says he hopes for an online romance, Artemis tells him she doesn't have that kind of time. My cyber porn addiction eats up most of my free time. Same. So even though they both should be trying to hunt the egg right now, Artemis is asking him questions about himself. Does he have a job? Is he in high school? Does he have time for an online romance? When Wade says he's going to graduate high school next week, Artemis says, you shouldn't reveal stuff like that. I could be a Sixer spy trying to profile you. Imagine. Oh, this is the episode where I'm going to talk about my Artemis as a Sixer spy theory at the end. Oh, wait for that. Wade refuses to answer any more questions until Artemis starts answering some of his. So they try and do a back and forth type of thing, taking turn answering one question each. Artemis says she's 19 years old and in college studying poetry and creative writing. And when Wade quips that she's an older woman compared to his 18 years old, she says, "If I am a woman..." And here we go again. Artemis asks how well he knows H. He said he's known him for 5 years. "Now, spill it. Are you a woman?" I don't even want to read this next sentence out. It's repellent. "And by that I mean, are you a human female who has never had a sex change operation?" What the fuck? Jesus Christ. Ernest Cline's self-insert being openly transphobic, and it's not even challenged. Artemis's only response is that it's a very specific question, and that "I am, and always have been, a human female." This is something I've just looked up while I was recording this, because I don't want to mishandle this in any sort of way. So the main character of this book is openly transphobic in this one point, and the transgender topic doesn't come up ever again. He's not challenged on his views at this or any other point in the narrative. The protagonist is supposed to be the relatable character. He's supposed to be the one with whom we go on the journey. We, the reader, are taught that this is an okay thing to believe. I'm just stunned. I'm just really annoyed. I'm even actively angry. Oh my god. If your main hero is never condemned for atrocious actions, then you and your narrative are part of the problem. Right, let's crack on. Artemis claims to have no siblings or surviving parents. Wade confirms back to her that he's not working in a duo with H, and that he gave her that tip about Joust just to be helpful. Artemis claims to be brunette with blue eyes, and as far as Wade knows, looks the same as her avatar. Favourite movie, Highlander, blah blah blah. Wade says, "When can we chat again? After one of us finds the egg. That could take years." So be it. So be it. If this is the quality of your conversation, please never subject me to one ever again. Artemis tells him to stop getting in touch, but Wade says he's going to persist in emailing her, and I'm sure his years of unhealthy cyberstalking are going to be rewarded by the narrative. Artemis, I guess, quips about blocking his email address, and after a mutual goodnight, the chat log ends. Okay, so we go back to prose at this point. We've got a passage here that's sort of a time passes montage, along with a told and not shown beginning of a romance between these two characters. It begins when Wade emails her once a week and is surprised that she always responds, albeit with one line saying that she's too busy. After a while, his persistence wears her down, which is of course the key to a good romance, and their emails start getting longer and more personal. At first a few times a week, then at least once a day and sometimes more. Whenever an email from her arrived in my inbox, I dropped everything to read it. Within the space of one paragraph, we find out that they start meeting in private chat rooms. We played vintage board games, watched movies, and listened to music. We talked for hours. Long, rambling conversations about everything under the sun. So again, told and not really shown what the connection is between these two people. We seemed to have everything in common. We shared the same interests. We were driven by the same goal. She got all of my jokes. She made me laugh. She made me think. She changed the way I saw the world. How so? Using your prose, tell me how your worldview has changed. Isn't it nice to find someone with common interests in a universe specifically built around common interests? In the space of another paragraph, we find out that their rivalry becomes all but forgotten, and they start sharing their theories and interpretations and what they're currently researching into. I couldn't make myself be cautious around her. A little voice in my head kept trying to tell me that every word she said could be disinformation and that she might just be playing me for a fool. But I didn't believe it. I trusted her, even though I had every reason not to. I'm the little voice saying that. And then in another paragraph we find out that Wade graduates school during June. The date on the chat log was February, so 4 months of time has passed in the space of four paragraphs. He graduates and they email him his diploma. "When I finished school, I'd intended to devote all of my time to the hunt, but all I really wanted to do was spend time with Artemis." We got another page break here heralding a new part of the narrative, in which Wade calls Artemis his new online pseudo-girlfriend, and has apparently started to nickname her Artie. Now that he's got nothing but free time, he started making the climb to 99, which is what Gunters call leveling up your avatar to the maximum. Artemis and H had both recently done it, and I felt compelled to catch up. So now that he's got nothing but free time and money, he explores the Oasis and completes every quest he can find, jumping up 5 or 6 levels in a day, and just getting more powerful. Because, you know, he wasn't overpowered before, was he? He wasn't completely overprepared with all his knowledge. And he also plays through a Goonies quest with Artemis. I don't give a shit about the Goonies. So I'm going to use this opportunity to say, why is he still getting money? It's been 4 months or more since he first rose to prominence. And people are still paying him for endorsement deals? When Saturday Night Live portrays you as an overweight, unwashed geek, surely that's going to be damaging to your reputation. How is it that the world's foremost Gunter is somehow a career option, and not just a level of forgettable overnight celebrity? We also get a bit more on Wade's research into the Quatrain, a 4-line poem that I'm not going to bother repeating here. There's a 13-line paragraph here about a late 60s Japanese TV show called The Space Giants, which had been dubbed in English and rebroadcast in the United States in the 70s and 80s. I've never heard of this, but Ernest Cline wants you to know that he definitely has heard of it. He knows there's an alien villain named Rodak. He knows there's a family of transforming robots living in a volcano. He knows the main character Miko blows a whistle, which is why it ties into the poem. But that entire paragraph, at the very end, is discounted as being irrelevant to the riddle. Ernest Cline just wants you to know he's heard of something you haven't heard of, and that he knows it better than you do. It's got nothing to do with advancing the plot. It's just a dead end. And then one Saturday morning, Wade's watching old 80s commercials for cereal, and that leads to an actual breakthrough. This is a real thing that happens in the book, and it is stupid. So inspired by seeing Cap'n Crunch, an American cereal mascot, he figures out the connection between the first and third lines of the quatrain. The captain conceals the jade key, but you can only blow the whistle. This refers to famous 70s hacker John Draper, alias Captain Crunch. Draper was one of the first phone freaks, and he was famous for discovering that the toy plastic whistles found as prizes in boxes of Cap'n Crunch cereal could be used to make free long-distance phone calls, because they emitted a 2600Hz tone that tricked the old analog phone system into giving you free access to the line. Which I've just looked up, and yeah, that's more or less true. But then there's a significant portion at the bottom of John Draper's Wikipedia page, involving allegations against him as part of the Me Too movement. Like the Revenge of the Nerds reference a few chapters ago, this is certainly not a reference that has aged well. Anyway, Wade reasons that the whistle that he needs is concealed in a box of Cap'n Crunch cereal. But he's got no idea where it could be, apart from the clue in the second line of the poem, in a dwelling long neglected. So he visits recreations of the Addams Family House, the abandoned shack in the Evil Dead trilogy, Tyler Durden's flophouse in Fight Club, and the Lars homestead on Tatooine. All things Ernest Cline has heard of, and he wants you to know he's heard of them too. Predictably, all of these are dead ends in the quest. He's still puzzling out the final line once the trophies are all collected. But that's as much progress as he makes. Every time I revisited the quatrain, my ongoing infatuation with Artemis would undermine my ability to focus, and before long I would close my Grail diary and call her up to see if she wanted to hang out. She almost always did. But it's fine that Wade is too horny to figure out the riddle, because from the looks of the scoreboard, nobody else has either. We've got another page break telling us that weeks pass, and Artemis and Wade spend more and more time with each other. A river of words flowed between us. But again, we don't actually find out what this river of words is. We are told and not shown. Though on reflection, if it's anything like that conversation from the start of the chapter, I'm kind of glad that we don't get to see it. So Wade, like a freaking idiot, has essentially told Artemis his life story, up to and including his real name. Whereas Artemis is kept shtum, and all he really knows is that she's 19, she lives in the Pacific Northwest, and that she insists she doesn't look like her avatar, even though that's what Wade continues to picture in his head when he thinks of her in real life. His spending more time with Artemis means that his friendship with H is being neglected. H knew I was falling for Artemis, but he never gave me too much grief about it, even when I would bail on him at the last minute to hang out with her instead. He would just shrug, tell me to be careful, and say, "I sure hope you know what you're doing, Z." Wade admits he doesn't know what he's doing, but he can't help it. I really don't like this next sentence. Somehow, without realizing it, my obsession with finding Halliday's Easter egg was gradually being supplanted by my obsession with Artemis. Oh my god. I... Now, Now they start going out on what Wade calls dates in quotation marks, because clearly that's how he thinks of them, and it's not the mutual consensus between them that that's what they are. Wade tells Artemis he no longer cares if the Sixers know that he's alive and if they try to attack him in the Oasis. And now that he's reached 99th level, he feels invincible. Maybe I was just trying to impress Artemis by acting fearless. If so, I think it worked. So they go to these exotic dates in disguise so that the tabloids don't pick up on it, apart from one exception. One night, she took me to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show in a huge stadium-sized movie theater on the planet Transsexual. I know that's a reference to the Rocky Horror song, but I also think that's not really a word we can use anymore. It's not really my place to say, and of course every trans person is different, but I feel like a cisgendered author should be a bit more responsible than using it as a name of a planet. But anyway, they go to this Rocky Horror Picture Show screening, and as in real life, there's audience participation with the showing of the film. Normally, only long-standing members of the Rocky Horror fan club were permitted to get up on stage and help act out the film in front of the giant movie screen. But Artemis used her fame to pull a few strings, and she and I were both allowed to join the cast for that night's show. The planet's a no PvP zone, so Wade feels safe enough to do that. Artemis plays Columbia, and Wade plays Eddie, the character who, in the film, is played by Meatloaf. And he alters his avatar to look just like Meatloaf. Side note, Meatloaf is also on my shit list. Artemis turns out to be better than him at performing the Rocky Horror Picture Show. My performance and lip-syncing still kinda sucked. Luckily, the audience cut me a lot of slack because I was the famous Gunter Parzival and I was clearly having a blast. After the show, Wade tells Artemis that that was the most fun he ever had in his entire life, and that was when she leaned over and kissed me for the first time. I couldn't feel it, of course, but it still set my heart racing. Despite the perils of falling for somebody over the internet, Wade has got it bad. And our last sentence in this chapter is, "And then one night, like a complete idiot, I told her how I felt." End chapter 17. God, that was a journey, wasn't it? I didn't like anything that just happened. And not just even from a personal perspective, some of that stuff was objectively actionable. I did say I would, so here's my Artemis is a spy conspiracy theory. So a couple of chapters ago, when Wade had his conversation with Nolan Sorrento, Sorrento said he's going down the scoreboard contacting each of the Gunters in turn. So it'd be Wade first, Artemis second, H third. After Wade logs out and his stack blows up, the first person he speaks to is H. And I feel like during that sort of time, Sorrento could have got in touch with Artemis. When the Gunters have their big meeting, Artemis is the one who's monitoring the situation at the flat-topped hill. She laughs and then covers up her laugh when Daito says there might be a sixth spy in their ranks. When H and Wade are the only two left in the chat room, that stack of books falls over or whatever, and Wade thinks there might be a spy. Artemis was the last one to leave, so if she knows how to make herself invisible or something, she could have pretended to have left and then remained there. And now for this entire chapter, she's been probing Wade for information. What his secret identity is and whether he works with H, and what progress he's made on the next riddle. And Wade, like an idiot, has actually shared all his research and theories with her. She even knows his real name. It's a honey trap. And the final nail in the coffin, and this one's a little bit more subjective, but she's going along with Wade despite the hundreds of red flags he's demonstrating. So either she's doing that because she's been instructed to, as part of the Sixers' plan to extract information, or she's just a poorly written female character. And the jury is definitely out on that one. I absolutely hated that chapter. I was going to record two episodes today, but after that, I'm not going to do another one now. That's a good place to stop, I think. What a terrible, terrible protagonist. If you liked my speaking out against regressive opinions and want more of it, you can follow me on Twitter at TheLastGherkin or follow the show on Twitter at RPN_pod. You can watch along with subtitles on YouTube, The Last Gherkin, or get an MP3 download at TheLastGherkin.podbean.com. Till next time, trans rights are human rights. Ba-da-da-bam. Talking volume. I literally just read that email. Why are you telling me about it now? I'd say it's nice that he's found someone... I keep forgetting to turn my... mute. End chapter 18. I thought we were on 17. Wait, hang on. Oh, wow, this font is terrible.